Hello, this is the recording for our class number 17 on October 20th. And in this class, we started talking about Heimovitz v. Eli Lilly. You know, as an overview here, we're talking about cause and fact, and it's just factual causation, third element in our cause of action for negligence. And everything I say about cause will also applies to cause in, say, intentional torts or cause in any other kind of personal injury action. We started with negligence, duty breach, but from now on, what we're saying about cause, proximate cause, can apply. We could have started with intentional torts very easily. A lot of torts casebooks do, and we'd still be having the same discussion about cause, in fact, and proximate cause. So whatever your cause of action is, negligence, intent, product liability, it still has to, after you've shown your basic elements of that are particular to that cause of action, you still get down to cause. You have to link whatever the cause of action is to the injury. And the first step is cause in fact, and that's just factual. We saw that last class with Stubbs. But for is our usual test, but for the negligent actions or intentional actions, whatever they were, of the defendant, the plaintiff would not have been injured. Sometimes it's usually not difficult to show that. But when it is difficult, it's extremely difficult. So we have our but-for test is the first thing you look at. But then sometimes there are a number of different possibilities for causation. Sometimes there are a number of different defendants. So courts have grappled with this, and as we saw in Stubbs, came up with a lesser than 100% but for. We're absolutely sure about this, and Stubbs' case talked about reasonable certainty that the negligence caused the injury. Substantial factor, we've seen that, we saw that as another test. It was the substantial factor. You just have to recognize that whenever you get down below the 100% but-for causation, you're going to have the possibility of people getting recoveries whose injuries were not actually caused by the defendant's negligence. Even if you get it to 99%, there's a possibility, and you just have to, if we drop below the but-for causation, and many jurisdictions have done that, you're going to have the potential that there's an overcompensation somewhere. In Stubbs, remember we said some people were going to get typhoid anyway. So our last class, we talked about a variety of toxic torts, real problems with the toxic torts, and we talked about a variety of ways to show that when you have multiple defendants, how to hold somebody liable for the negligence of another. Alternative liability, Summers v. Tice, shifts the burden to the negligent defendants themselves. Two negligent, maybe three negligent defendants. Also, concerted action. Individuals get together and agree to do the tortious activity. Any one of them, based on this agreement, if one of them injures another, all the defendants are going to be liable for that injury. Very much like the felony murder rule. One participant in a felony, the guy who drives the car is going to be liable for the murder, even though he didn't do it. And then also enterprise liability was mentioned in the book, enterprise liability. Mentioned much later. That was mentioned today, but it's another way to share liability when you didn't actually cause the injury. So today we moved into a whole other area, one of the more controversial decisions in tort lore and tort case law, with the Heimovitz case. And again, a lot of problems with this case. The one problem we didn't have was knowing what caused the injury. It was DES. We know the drug caused the injury. So it was different. We had a long latency period, 20 or 30 years, perhaps. Statute of limitation problems. A number of cases have those. But what we had here that we didn't have a problematic here, that's very frequently problematic in other long latency cases, is we know what caused it, DES. What we didn't know is who manufactured it, because there were so many manufacturers. So our other theories of multiple defendants wouldn't work. That is, alternate liability under Summers v. Tice, too many defendants, three inner manufacturers, wouldn't do. Enterprise liability, too many defendants. Concerted action, no indication that there was an agreement. What we had was a bad pill, and a bad pill it caused. There was some disagreement, but I call a pill that causes death to be bad. It wasn't negligently manufactured. It was just, we had under product liability, they don't require that. It's just the manufacturer. Question came up about FDA approval. Why didn't that just solve the case? It's not a. We'll talk about that under when we talk about defenses, the defense of preemption. Why isn't the whole thing preempted by saying that you have government approval? Well, it isn't in state cases, or is it? There's been some recent legislation, recent cases that have come out that may make a change in this area of the law. But right, in this case, state courts, even though federal may not be able to bring in federal courts, federal approval does not preempt state product liability cases. So government immunity, you can't sue the FDA, so here we are. If you can't, if you're not able to find a likely a good defendant here, our plaintiffs were going to be out of luck. The theory of market share liability was devised for the very first time, and for this very purpose, by the California Court of Sindel. Market share liability, all it says is when you've got many, many, many defendants, and you can't tell which defendant actually manufactured the particular pill that caused the particular plaintiff's injuries, you can bring them all together and hold them liable under for their share of the market in that particular piece of medication. So, Sindel and then Brown affirmed the market share liability theory of action. Here, Heimowitz extended it. They decided a number of questions left open by Sindel. Big question. If you couldn't get all 300 manufacturers together, could you still sue? Could you still get 100% of your injuries? Answer, no. You're only going to recover for the the defendants, the manufacturers you manage to bring into the action. If you bring, so what does that really mean? Practically, you're going to go after the big guys. You're not going to try to get 100 little guys. You're going to go after the Mercks and the Eli Lillys, for example. The big, and maybe just Eli Lilly. This is, if Eli Lilly had 60% of the market, go after Eli Lilly and not worry about it. Or maybe another defendant. But maybe a Lilly and a Merck to put together. But the if you got less than 100% of the market in your lawsuit, you're only going to get 100. You're going to get less than 100% of your recovery. So the market share depended on the number of defendants and the total market share that you managed to get into the suit. That was your recovery. Second, is it liability on the defendant's part, joint and several, that is liable for your own share plus for the whole or several only? And the answer in this case, it's several only. So Eli Lilly, if it had 60% of the market and is only going to be liable for that 60%, not the 80% that you managed to bring into the action. And question, can you get out if you prove that you didn't? And the market, is it national or regional? It's got to be national. One market for all of the litigation. So it's not one plaintiff comes in and says, well, I'm from upstate and I lived in upstate, market of the upstate. Oh, I'm only Manhattan, market for Manhattan. So it's a national market. And the court acknowledges that a lot of these things are arbitrary. They said, we're doing these things for practical purposes. One market for everybody. We don't have to formulate a market for each individual plaintiff. A big thing for these particular plaintiffs is that you do not the defendant does not get the opportunity to exculpate themselves from the case. That is, if they prove that they couldn't have possibly provided the DES to any individual plaintiff, the plaintiff says, well, I don't know who the manufacturer was, but I bought it in the Rexall. And a manufacturer shows that they didn't buy it in the Rexall, they still can't get out of the market share. So it's a totally arbitrary kind of way of recovery, which is why I called it more of a system of insurance than liability. It's a way that the courts devised to spread the loss, and that's what insurance is loss spreading. Spread the loss in proportion to the risk that it created. Spread the loss in proportion to the risk you created. And market share liability worked in this case, was appropriate in this case. It was a big, very controversial decision, appropriate in this case, but it hasn't really been applied very successfully in other cases. The book talks about lead paint. That's a perfect one. Walls, all manufacturers at one point manufactured paint with lead in it. Tenements painted with this particular kind of paint 20 years after it was painted. Lead flakes off. Kids eat the paint, become very ill. Nobody was around who remembers what who the manufacturer, everybody manufactured this kind of paint. Can we do market share liability? This has been been attempted in certain kind of asbestos, been attempted to certain kind of product liability cases to more or less success. The thing to remember is that it was a decision, a practical decision, and a social decision on these parts to go with this. And courts, when you come with these kind of, as I always said, these toxic torts, courts grapple with fairness and are, you know, we don't punish, but we want to compensate and deter the risky activities. So a very, very famous case. We moved on to then talk about our other major causation question here, which is proximate cause. And I said proximate cause is a question of, it's not related to proximate or cause. It's not going to be an issue in every case. I'm driving down Worth Street negligently. I hit you. I break your leg. I'm the actual and I'm the fact, cause in fact and the proximate cause of that injury. So it's not always, you have to look at the facts of every case to determine if proximate cause is going to be an issue. Proximate cause in fact can go on to infinity. Proximate cause is a search for where to draw the line. So it's more of a matter of policy than anything else. When does the defendant's responsibility for his or her negligent act end? And there's lots of ways to formulate this, but I'd like you to think in terms of just defining the scope of the risk. Your responsibility should not extend beyond the scope of the risk created by your negligent actions. Define the scope of the risk created by the negligent behavior. Is there something about the injury, how the injury itself, how it came about, who was injured, that is beyond the scope of the risk? And we always say the scope of the foreseeable risk. We use foreseeability, and we've seen foreseeability used before to limit liability, and we saw that in duty questions under, say, economic law, pure economic loss, or emotional distress. Limitation on liability, here it is again, a limitation liability, only it's in terms of causation, not duty, not negligence. So distinguish between duty and proximate cause. They're both limitations to liability, but duty goes to negligence, proximate cause goes to the injury. Someone's behavior may have been said to be the cause of a very foreseeable type of injury, but may still not be held to be liable because the law says that a person was under no duty to the plaintiff. Duty is a policy question, but it's a separate one from proximate cause. So, for example, I could give guests liquor in my home, making them drunk, and it's very foreseeable that they're going to go out and get into an automobile accident, but the law says I had no duty to the third party. So duty is policy, proximate cause is policy, but they're two separate proximate causes. So proximate cause is only an issue when negligence is established and cause in fact is established, and only when there's something unusual about the injury. So the requirement is not either cause in fact or legal cause, it's both. Proximate cause is legal cause, and cause in fact is factual cause. So we talk about something, look to see whether there's something unexpected. I think that's a helpful way to do it. In order to define the scope of the risk, we look to see if there's something that's unexpected. Have we gone beyond the scope of that risk? So it's Proximate is an unhelpful word. I'm trying to find, I endeavor to get other helpful ways to define the scope of the risk. Did the defendant's behavior create special risks that plaintiff wouldn't have been subjected to otherwise? Is there something about the outcome, the plaintiff, the result that is so unexpected or unforeseeable that we want to limit liability by saying it's just beyond, that what happened was beyond the risk created by the negligent behavior? And when we see in the Bend case, when we're talking about impact upon a person, the courts are willing to open the door to some very unforeseen extent. When we have a physical injury, courts will look, will get around the rule of foreseeability to allow recoveries for some quite unforeseeable consequences when they follow upon the impact. And the Bend case is an example of this, our rule of the eggshell scald plaintiff. We had an impact on a car, our plaintiff was injured, and because of the impact, our plaintiff then, or we don't know if it was because, but we know that the plaintiff who had a predisposition to heart problems died of a heart attack after this rear-ender that would have only caused whiplash at the most. The plaintiff wanted a jury instruction on an eggshell skull. The defendant just wanted a basic, you're liable for what you cause. And the jury brought back, said, well, I caused a leg and a chest injury. So the question was about, should the eggshell skull plaintiff jury instruction have been given? And the answer is yes. The jury instruction, here we had an unexpected type of harm, definitely extent of harm was unexpected, and maybe the type of harm was unexpected. But the eggshell skull plaintiff rule rejects foreseeability. Once some injury is foreseeable, you're liable for all the injury that's foreseeable. Was it foreseeable that someone would die from a rear ender? No, but it's irrelevant under eggshell skull. Why do we have such a rule? We already use foreseeability as an outer limit, but foreseeability is not unqualified. Reasonably foreseeable. Duty to avoid reasonably foreseeable risks to reasonably foreseeable parties. Basically, this eggshell policy says that a deserving plaintiff collects. A deserving plaintiff should collect. You take your plaintiff as you find them. So the limit can come on damages, but you have to open the door to recovery for all the potential injuries, including the heart, including the death by heart attack. So if a defendant could prove that the plaintiff's heart was so weak, he only had a short time to live, still liable for the death, but maybe for the short time. Could affect the damages. Otherwise, a negligent defendant is going to benefit from hitting a terminally ill person on the way to the hospice. That's one of our hypotheticals. You want your negligence to you don't want to go beyond the scope of your negligence, but it shouldn't be a luck of the draw thing. It shouldn't be You shouldn't say, well, this is just a rear-ender, and if it was a normal person, they wouldn't have died. My person died. Why should I suffer? You suffer because you're negligent. So a negligent defendant's not going to be protected. Eggshell skull, if you've created, eggshell skull takes in the risk. You created a risk. Plaintiff wouldn't have been subjected to this risk otherwise, except through the negligence, so the defendant stays liable. You know, at some point, the risk has to end, normal life has to resume, but at what point is that? So note the note all of the problems at the end. Medical aggravation, put them be cash and carry. Aggravation, it's foreseeable that if you injure somebody, they get in an ambulance, something else is going to happen. You put them in that ambulance. Compare that with note number 9 on 406. Defendant negligently broke plaintiff's leg while plaintiff was recovering. His crutch slipped and the leg was rebroken. Aggravation, they put him in the cast, but 10 years later in a fire, his inability to run away, probably beyond the limits of proximate cause. Eggshell skull doesn't extend to property damage. I hit your car. It bends your bumper, but you're carrying around a Picasso. I'm not liable for that Picasso. Property damage is one thing. I'm going to be liable for your car, but you carrying around a Picasso is there's no eggshell car rule. You should have insured that Picasso. So that's very unforeseeable. I'm only going to be reliable. The proximate cause will draw a circle around the scope of that risk. And again, Dillon v. Twin State. Boy falls from a high bridge, loses balance while playing. On the way down from the high bridge, we see that he grabs a negligently non-insulated wire and dies from electrocution on the way down. The defendant's in charge of that negligently insulated wire. Is the defendant going to be liable for the death? The death was going to be certain. He was on his way down. The defendant kills him a little bit beforehand. The court says, yeah, if by falling he didn't have long to live, you're liable only for a limited earning capacity. He had 15 minutes to live, so 15 minutes of life. So read over the no cases. Steinhauser, precipitation, the suicide cases, all interesting, talking about the limits to proximate cause when there's been a physical injury. So, you know, where does the unexpectedness, where does the eggshell stop and remoteness begin? So after eggshell, we're going to talk about, we're going to pick up on 406, Palemis and Wagon Mound, not eggshell plaintiffs, not involving injury to a person. So we get back into our regular rules of proximate cause. So Palemis, Wagon Mound, and then we'll go to Dovey Mannheimer on Monday.